Welcome to Studio 2. I'm Cherry Gregg.
And I'm Avi Wolfman-Aaron. It's a new week.
It is a new
week. It's a new episode of Studio 2.
Yay!
And what is coming up this hour, Cherry? Well, we're going to start by talking about the Pennsylvania primary, 1 week from today.
I know. A lot of people forgot we have a primary coming up.
It's really going to happen, folks.
Yeah.
Whether you're interested or not, we're going to get you interested today, actually, because we're going to talk with Katie Meyer of Spotlight PA, a WHYY alum. No one knows statewide politics better than Katie. She's going to tell us what's on the ballot, you know, how people are positioning themselves, which races to watch. It's sort of like when there isn't one big race to draw all the attention in, it can make things a little bit more complicated. So we're going to kind of sort through it all today.
And we do have some competitive races.
Very competitive.
That could have a lot of influence, not just statewide, but also on national politics.
Totally.
So you kind of want to pay attention and make sure you cast your ballot next week.
And it's such a weird year because it's not just right that the presidential primary has basically been decided, but also normally there would be a big primary for U.S. Senate.
Yeah.
But basically the Republicans are only running one person and the Democrat is an incumbent. So it's just a weird year overall. So I'm looking forward to that conversation with Katie. Middle segment today.
I know one you probably will like.
This is the main course. Pun intended. We're going to talk with Craig Laban, who's the restaurant critic at The Enquirer, longtime, you know, Philly food scene tastemaker, great writer, great reporter. He's going to tell us a little bit about his job.
Yeah.
But also just what to look for in the Philly food scene.
Yeah. It seems like a pretty cool job. You know, you get to eat out all the time. Deliciousness. You know, I mean, you know, staying and you get to be incognito, basically. You have to
Is
be
that
incognito.
A dream of yours? Yeah.
Sometimes, you know, sometimes.
Well, you're on the radio. That helps.
So, yeah. Looking forward to our chat with Craig.
And then another name you know, Mike and Scott. Mike and Scott host The Pulse on WHYY. Listen to it Mondays at noon. And she recently took, I guess is the verb you would use. She recently took a sound bath. What is a sound bath? Mikan's going to tell us, a little bit about the science maybe behind it.
Yeah.
And play a little sound for us.
I'm looking forward to that because, you know, I love sounds to de-stress. And
you do.
I do. I really believe, you know, I'm into meditation, all those things. So I'm looking forward to this. I've never been to a sound bath, never heard of it, but Mikan's going to enlighten us. You can give us a call, 888-477-9499. If you have questions for Craig or even Mikan, you can also email studio2@whyy.org.
Or even Mikan. Come on.
Yeah. I didn't mean to throw Mikan. Yeah. I mean, or Mikan.
There we go.
Or Mikan.
There we go.
If you have questions for Mikan about sound bath.
Okay, let's do some news headlines.
Yes.
Boy, we're really dithering today. Go ahead.
Well, the GOP is trying to convince more Republicans to send in mail-in ballots.
Specifically here in Pennsylvania.
In Pennsylvania. The primary is next Tuesday, the 23rd. We mentioned that. And today is the last day to apply for a mail-in ballot. And that's why Pennsylvania Republicans, they are wishing that they had embraced mail-in ballots prior to now. Donald Trump has raised all kinds of concerns about mail-in ballots. He has questioned their legitimacy, falsely saying they're connected to voter fraud. And Republicans sort of picked up on that rhetoric, Avi. And now, you know, Democrats have had a major advantage.
Huge
advantage with their voters sending in those mail-in ballots. And, you know, this is a swing state. It's going to be close, very likely, according to a lot of the polling. And so having that advantage of people being able to just send it in, even if not available to go in on the day of, would be big. And so you have a group now, they're called Win Again PA. They're trying to persuade voters to vote by mail instead of relying on same day voting. But of course, they are running up against the Trump messaging.
Yep. It's tough. Alfred Lobrano had a great piece in The Enquirer that published recently just about this issue. And it's particularly salient, I think, in Pennsylvania, because there are some swing states where like alternative forms of voting, whether absentee, early, mail-in, they already had a foothold before the Trump phenomenon. So in those places, I think it's a little easier to convince Republicans to trust that system. Here in Pennsylvania, we've really only had the no-excuses system post-pandemic, in the Trump era. So if you're a Pennsylvania Republican, your entire exposure to this concept is in the framework of Trump. And it's a huge issue because, as you mentioned, first of all, people might just not turn up on election day, yep. but also mm-hmm. from an organizing perspective, if you're able to bank votes ahead of time, you can concentrate your day of efforts on the voters who haven't voted yet. Mm-hmm. And that's a huge organizing advantage. And look, there are many reasons for this, but here in Pennsylvania, post-pandemic elections have tended to go the Democrats' way.
They have.
Senate, governor, presidential, mm-hmm. state Supreme Court. That's not all because of this, but look, Republicans are trying to claw their way back, and you can't just give away advantages for no reason.
Yeah, and people use, and Republicans, there were more Republicans who used to turn in the absentee ballot.
Yeah,
before
they used to have an advantage here.
No one had any problems with it, but for some reason now, you know, there's this issue with mail-in balloting. By the way, mail-in voting has been shown repeatedly to be safe and reliable. It's particularly popular with older voters and in rural communities where you got to catch a ride or two
to get
to your poll.
And because of the Trump messaging in some of those rural areas, they have very few drop boxes mm-hmm. where there are more.
So they've made it harder for Republicans.
Absolutely. Yeah. They have to find a way past this mm-hmm. in the future. I think this next story might be filed under We Spoke It Into Existence?
Did we not?
I don't know. Okay, maybe giving ourselves too much credit. Mm-hmm. But last week we did talk about the WNBA maybe expanding to Philadelphia. Mm-hmm. Yesterday the WNBA held its draft, which also means there was a media availability for Commissioner Kathy Engelbert, who talked about the possibility of expansion. And I think we have a clip lined up. Here is what she had to say.
It's complex because you need arena and practice facility and player housing. And so the nice thing is we're getting a lot of calls. We continue to engage with cities. I'll throw some of those out there because I've already thrown them out there. We continue to engage with cities like Philadelphia and Toronto and Portland and Denver and Nashville and South Florida.
Philadelphia.
First on the
list. Philadelphia. So the league wants to expand to 16 teams by 2028. Mm-hmm. There's only 12 right now. There's one more slot that we think the Bay Area is definitely going to take, but that's three open slots by 2028. The other interesting thing here, Cherry, is that Jonathan Tannenwald of the Inquirer tried to sort of push the commissioner mm-hmm. on, you know, where Philadelphia is in this, you know,
list.
Galaxy. Mm-hmm. And I think the upshot is that there is an investor or bidding team that is Philadelphia associated. Mm-hmm. Tannenwald reported that. We don't know who's part of it. We don't know what their pitch is, but this is not a nebulous concept. There are real people who want to bring a team to Philadelphia.
That makes me so excited. And I have to say, I've never watched the WNBA draft until Monday. That was my first time. It was trending on X, right? Lots of people talking about it on Monday night, which was pretty cool. By the way, last year, the draft attracted about 500,000 viewers on ESPN. Looking forward to seeing what those numbers are for 2024, because in 2025, the broadcast contract is up.
Yes.
So this is a big deal for the WNBA
and a
chance for them to make more money. And Avi, by the way, I went online to get tickets to see the Indianapolis Fever when they go down to Washington to play the Mystics.
Explain why the Fever.
By the way, Caitlin Clark was drafted number one, and she's with the Fever now, right? And I was like, all right, when she come to D.C., your girl's going to be there. But the tickets, Avi, within minutes of her getting drafted, you can't get a ticket in Washington, D.C. The average price is over $300 when a typical WNBA ticket is like $40.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's jaw-dropping.
Both Philly and D.C. and New York, hundreds of dollars. If you go to Indianapolis, $45.
All right, road trip. So one more story I want to get through real quickly, and this is a far more serious matter.
Yes.
Go ahead, Cherry.
The Anti-Defamation League is reporting a sharp rise in anti-Semitic incidents across the country. Pennsylvania, Avi, also saw a sharp rise in anti-Semitic incidents amid the Israel-Hamas war in Gaza. Now, let's get the numbers. The ADL tracked about 8,800 plus anti-Semitic incidents nationally. That's a 140% increase over last year, over the year before. I apologize.
22-23.
And Pennsylvania accounted for about 394 incidents, the sixth highest total. But I got to point out that some people take real issue with these numbers. Because
the methodology
a pro-Palestinian activist have said that anytime there was like a protest criticizing the Israel's position in the war or whatever actions they've taken, they've been lumped into these numbers.
Right.
And included
certain phrases, for instance, river
as
to
anti-Semitic.
The sea.
And so that is an issue with that. But still, many more incidents reported as anti-Semitism post the beginning of this war, October 7th.
And similar reports of rising Islamophobia here in the region and across the country.
Mm-hmm.
I will point out something that sort of removes the context of whether or not it was a protest and what the messaging was. There's also been an uptick in bomb threats. And that has, right, you could say that that definitively has nothing to do
with
what you said and how it can be framed, right? So a significant uptick here in Pennsylvania in bomb threats that are targeted toward Jewish institutions. So that is troubling.
Yeah, that is very troubling.
So we want to pivot now to our newsmaker. Mm-hmm. 1 week from today, Pennsylvanians head to the polls for a primary election. Yes, they do. State House, state Senate races are on the ballot. We've also got intriguing races for Attorney General, Auditor General, Treasurer, etc. Katie Meyer knows state politics inside and out. She's the government editor and reporter for Spotlight PA and joins us now in studio. Welcome back to the program, Katie.
Oh, so good to be here.
Nice to see you, Katie.
Nice to see you guys.
And so we're going to jump right in. The presidential primary basically already decided Trump versus Biden, but we have some statewide races. Attorney General Bart, you know, the most competitive, five Democrats versus two Republicans. Lay it all out for us.
So many Democrats in this
race.
Many
Democrats.
So I'll keep it like brief, but I'll give you the rundown. So the Democrats in this race, and I should actually just preface. So Attorney General, for anyone who doesn't know, top prosecutor in the state. It's basically the person who represents Pennsylvania if Pennsylvania gets sued. It's also a really notable springboard to hire office.
Yeah.
And
mm-hmm.
so, you know, you look at our governor right now, Josh Shapiro. He was the Attorney General quite recently. All of these row offices are kind of in that similar vein. But yeah, it was just really races to watch always. So the Democrats in this race, we should say it's an open primary. So on both sides of the aisle, it's anybody's game. There is an incumbent, but she was an appointed incumbent, and so she's not running again. So Democrats, Keir Bradford Gray, she's a Philly-based former chief public defender for both Montgomery County and Philly. She headed the Defender Association of Philadelphia. So, again, a very public defense-oriented person. That's notable.
Sounds sort of Krasner-ish.
You know, there's some commonality for sure, but I wouldn't say they're the same person.
And they've had disagreements, yeah.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Well, yeah, exactly. You know, Philly's a big place. Eugene DePasquale, he is Pittsburgh-based, the former auditor general. He was also mm-hmm. a state representative. Now he's a professor at University of Pittsburgh. We've got Joe Kahn. He is a Philly guy, but now he is, he was most recently the Bucks County solicitor. He was also an ADA, an assistant district attorney in Philadelphia. Jared Solomon, also a Philly guy. He was in the Army Reserves. He was a JAG officer, a Judge Advocate General's Corps officer. He's now a state representative for the 202nd District. And then we got Jack Stoltzheimer. He was an ADA in Delaware County, assistant district attorney. And now he is Delaware County's district attorney. So that's the field there.
That's the field. And, mm-hmm. you know, with races like this that are, you know, kind of lower information races, sometimes geography matters a lot. Mm-hmm. And I feel like everyone except one person in that race is Eastern Pennsylvania.
It's a very Eastern Pennsylvania race. Mm. And so you'll see that in a couple ways. But one thing we like to look at is the campaign finance.
Yep.
And so you got a lot of jockeying for the big donors in the Philadelphia area. So you've got Gene DePasquale. He has in Pittsburgh area focused out there. But then everybody else is really just in this southeastern region. And it's interesting, too, because that's where all the big money has come from. So mm-hmm. you see Jared Solomon. He has a pretty big cash advantage. He got money from John Middleton, who owns the Phillies.
Ah.
He's done pretty well. Jack Stoltzheimer's also been a pretty big fundraiser. He's gotten a lot of labor support. Keir Bradford Gray, kind of different kettle of fish. You know, she's gotten a lot more support from elected officials like Tony Williams, Vince Hughes. So you see it there.
This sounds so so wide open right
it's
now.
It's so wide open. Yeah. And that's the other thing I think we should stress here is that there has been no party endorsement in this primary.
And on the other side, I think it's a little different, right?
Yeah. So, yeah, we can actually, and let's get the Republicans in here. So that's a two-person race. That's Dave Sunday, who is the York County District Attorney, and Craig Williams. He's got a prosecutor background, and he's currently the state rep for the 160th District, which is Delco and Chester, and that's interesting because it's not a very Republican area. Mm. So that's one of his pitches. He can win in these areas. But Sunday has the party endorsement. And so you've seen that a little bit more in terms of like who's giving to him, who's endorsed him. The Democratic side, because there's been no endorsement, there hasn't been that sort of like coalescing around a specific candidate. So you're right, Avi. It's very wide open. Wow.
Got to ask you about this last question about the AG. But I mean, nationally, this role, like whoever gets this position could have national influence.
Oh, absolutely. And you saw this a lot, for instance, in the 2020 election when Pennsylvania was in the midst of a lot of lawsuits over who had won the election. The Trump campaign was, you know, challenging various parts of the results. Josh Shapiro became a very prominent figure. He was on MSNBC all the time in those years, and it was because he was often the person defending or leading the defense of Pennsylvania's election practices. So you saw that. I mean, you've seen the Attorney General's office do other big things, like there was a huge report several years ago on sexual abuse in the Catholic Church. Yep. That was a grand jury investigation. So those kinds of things, absolutely, they get it's a lot of prominence.
Yeah. Just a couple more minutes, Katie. Auditor General, Treasurer, State House, State Senate. Is there one other race that you would say watch this space?
I don't know about one other, but I'll just say briefly. So the treasurer race and the auditor general race, they're a little bit different because there are incumbents in both of those.
Both GOP incumbents,
both
right?
Both GOP incumbents and pretty different GOP incumbents. So the treasurer race, that's Stacey Garrity, who's been a pretty political figure. She was a big supporter of Donald Trump and has endorsed him again. But then Tim DeFore, the auditor general, has really, I think, you know, consciously made the office not very political. So that's kind of interesting in terms of the dynamic
contrast
there.
Yeah.
And then I'll always kind of plug the State House and Senate races because we like watching those. And those are very narrow chambers right now. The State House specifically, there's just a couple votes that determine who controls it. And the Senate, the Democrats think that it's in play. So both parties in both chambers are really trying to either seize or keep control.
Did I see that Brian Cutler, who leads the GOP caucus in the State House, has a real challenger?
He has a real challenger.
We have seen some big GOP leaders get unseated recently, right?
We have. And that one is interesting. He's a Lancaster County guy. He is facing a challenge from the right. There are a couple instances of that happening. And so that's something you're seeing in these sort of suburbanizing areas of Pennsylvania where there are these, incumbents who, are very conservative, but, are a little bit vulnerable to people who think they're not conservative enough and that, these areas should be more deeply to the right. So, it's an interesting dynamic to watch for sure.
And so I'm thinking about the U.S. race for Senate. Yeah. I know that, it's pretty much lined up. You mentioned Bob Casey versus David McCormick. Mm-hmm. Any insights on what it's going to look like in November?
That is a good question. There was just a great Inquirer article sort of musing about whether Bob Casey is, I don't remember the exact
oatmeal,
word they
maybe?
Used. Yeah, it was like oatmeal. Basically, is he too boring to be in the Senate? Bob Casey's been a very successful senator. He's a longtime senator in Pennsylvania. And I say successes, and he's really held that seat easily for years. Mm-hmm. And Casey is a very well-known name in Pennsylvania. So hard guy to unseat. It is an interesting dynamic, though. Dave McCormick, who ran before, really, bringing a little bit more national attention to that race.
And I will point out, I believe Bob Casey Jr. was both treasurer and maybe auditor general.
I wasn't sure if that was a very fun fact. I think it's a fun fact.
Well, but it goes to what you're talking about before.
These row office elections
are so important for the state's political future.
Absolutely, yeah.
Now you got some reasons to vote, right, folks?
Yeah, because
there are a lot of intriguing races.
And as we wrap up, any expectations about post, election day lawsuits, anything like that, and this primary?
Yeah, it's always possible, right? Pennsylvania, our election laws right now are a little bit scattershot in different ways. So, like, some things are based on precedent instead of, enacted law, which just, it increases the likelihood that there's going to be some sort of a legal gray area with some part of the election. So it's always something we've got on our radar. I think that's going to be more of an issue in the general election. Yeah. I will say say, I'm just going to plug something from Spotlight, though. If you real have quick. Time, yeah. If you're struggling to pick a candidate, we do have an Attorney General quiz
that
you
can take
that will That's hopefully help cool. you figure out who to vote for.
That's a good plug. Katie yeah. Meyer, government editor and reporter for Spotlight PA. Thanks for joining us, Katie.
Happy to be here.
Craig LeBan.
Coming up next.
Let's eat. All right, welcome back, everybody, to Studio 2. I'm Avi Wolf-Manera.
And I'm Cherry Gregg. Avi, you know I love my job,
love
right?
Love your job.
But I've often thought about, you know, that Philadelphia Inquirer restaurant critic, Craig LeBan, you know him? He has a pretty good gig.
Yeah.
I mean, imagine going out for great meals day after day, sampling amazing dishes. I don't think I would have complained if that was my job.
Well, but they're not all great meals.
Oh.
And you have to write a review that has the potential to make or break a restaurant. It's a lot of pressure.
Yeah, that's
and
true.
Not to yuck your yum, though. Mm. But we wanted to ask the elusive Craig LeBan about his job eating out, the Philly dining scene in general, and how hard it's been keeping a low profile all these years, especially in the social media age. He is with us now in Studio 2. Craig, welcome.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm really glad to be back.
Yeah. And of course, listeners, if you have a question for Craig or a favorite restaurant you want to share, our phone lines are open. The number is 888-477-9499. You can also email us at studio2@whyy.org.
I want to start kind of wide here, Craig. When you look at the Philly food scene right now, what really gets you excited, makes your heart skip a beat?
We've gotten a lot of national attention in the last year for our restaurant scene, and it is well-deserved because you have some real stars right now on the restaurant scene who are making national waves. I'm talking about Chef Nuck at Kalaya.
Mm-hmm.
You know, one of America's great Thai restaurants. It's really helped put Philly, you know, back on the map in the way that Zahav might have done, you know, a couple years ago. And Friday, Saturday, Sunday was named the best restaurant in America by the James Beard Foundation last year.
So good.
And that's Friday, Saturday, Sunday is a 50-year-old restaurant, and it's got new owners, it's stayed fresh, and it's stayed relevant. And that's exciting to see a city with deep roots kind of keep evolving. But we have so many new restaurants going on, so many young talents. You look at Amanda Schulman, who has her place, Supper Club, and last year she opened a restaurant with her now husband, Alex Kemp, called Mailu, which is sort of
Is that the French-Canadian?
Right. They both have a Montreal connection. They both cooked in Montreal together. Alex is from Montreal, so it's really like a French-Canadian bistro channeling Philadelphia produce and seasonality. And it's this very exciting place where they're just cooking just wonderful food. And, you know, we have so many restaurants going on right now. Our Mexican dining scene is continuously growing. I've been writing a lot about how our Mexican community has sort of grown over the last quarter century, and now you have second generation operators who become entrepreneurs, and they're sort of realizing these restaurant dreams, and so many stories within the stories to tell behind the food. And that's the exciting part for me, is being able to talk about food as a window into our city, our, you know, our culture and who we are and how we are evolving, you know, as Philadelphia.
And I got to say, like, hearing you talk about the food scene, your face is all lit up. By the way, not many people know what you actually look like, but it's burned into our brains now. But, like, just hearing you, you've been doing this for more than 2.5 decades at this point in Philly. And, you know, what has it been like for you? Like, because you have, you've helped to put a lot of places on the map, also can douse some in flames. What is all of that like?
Well, first of all, you know, it's a great privilege to be able to do this, to be able to go out to eat and, you know, eat at all these restaurants and get a chance to sort of tell the stories of the people in these restaurants and try to relate it to what it means mm-hmm. to the city. And it's this wonderful relationship that you build with readers over time because, you have this very direct connection. You're sending people out to eat at restaurants, sometimes spending hundreds of dollars on a meal every week, and you multiply that by however many thousands of people read a column. And you really have to prove yourself to readers over time as a trustworthy source of somebody who's independent, who's honest, who has good taste, who also has an appreciation for food and culture. And that's the thing. I love eating out. I love restaurants. I love food. I love new flavors to me. I love learning about food and who we are. And so it's been fun as a reporter also to sort of look at the city and ask questions about the city through food. Mm-hmm. And to see, you know, Philadelphia has evolved so much over the last quarter century in so many ways, but food has been a major part of that cultural push. Yeah. It's one of the things, like our, as much as our sports teams, that people now think of Philadelphia as a food city. And I've been able to watch it grow and evolve and take root. And that's really exciting. That's very rewarding when you see your town finally get some acknowledgement nationally, like we did last year at the James Beard Foundation Awards. And so there's a lot of pride. But there's also the excitement of what's new, what's around the corner. There's always new things. And to see neighborhoods kind of evolve through the restaurants. And so often, I'm one of the first reporters from the Inquirer to be able to talk about certain neighborhoods evolving and changing because restaurants, that little BYOB on the corner or the gastropub or the coffee shop is sometimes it's the first little canary in the coal mine that something's going on.
It totally is. And by the way, you talked about things evolving and trends emerging. Are there sort of identifiable dining trends right now? I mean, you just talked about some of the stuff that's happening in Philly, but sort of more broadly, like, is there some sort of change in taste, in cuisine, in service style that you can identify as sort of happening now, bubbling up now?
Well, there's a lot of them, and a lot of them have come out of the pandemic. You know, the move towards tasting menus in a lot of ways. Mm-hmm. You see them in all shapes and forms. You know, from modest, more modest prefix up to, I'm just about to write about a number of $300 tasting menus that we have in town. Oh. So, those kind of experiences have resulted from people grappling with labor challenges and trying to balance that with trying to turn out ambitious food. And at the same time...
Oh, interesting. What's the connection there? I'd never even thought about those things.
Well, for example, when staffs were short during the pandemic, coming out of the pandemic, a lot of restaurants that had a menu, say, of like 25 or 30 different items were like, instead of cooking that, let's set up a menu with, eight courses that it's the same menu. Everybody gets the same thing for 2 weeks. And you know exactly how much food you're going to prepare. You pre-sell the tickets. So there's a lot of efficiency in that.
You streamline the operation.
That's correct. Wow. And then also, and for a lot of people, like Friday, Saturday, Sunday was a good example of that. Mm-hmm. I think the sort of the discipline of trying to refine all your creative thoughts down to a menu, which becomes like a narrative or a tasting arc, really helped push them creatively to define who they were.
As a diner, I also just love that experience.
Yes.
I love like sitting back and them just sort of being like, this is what we got for you
and
today.
And it breaks you out of the monotony because a lot of times you go to restaurants, you pick the exact same thing all the time.
Yes.
And this forces you to open your mind a little
bit.
That's
true. And then the flip side of it is my wife doesn't like those because she likes to be in total control of everything she's eating.
You got to seed control.
She doesn't want to be surprised. So it's not for everybody. But, another great example, and this is one of the restaurants that I'm really excited about this year, is Honeysuckle Projects, Honeysuckle Provisions. In West Philadelphia.
Yes.
And this is Omar Tate and Sybil St. Aude Tate, couple. They opened this Afrocentric grocery market cafe in West Philadelphia, I guess it was a year ago, with a vision to create it as a sort of a community center focused on exploring black food ways from a northern perspective. And they had a breakfast and a lunch sort of takeout menu primarily. It was really excellent. And Omar debuted tasting menus for dinner at night, and it's an extraordinary experience because he's a performance artist. He's a visual artist, and there's poetry.
It's a show.
Wow.
It's a show, and all those things kind of come together, and he has the most unique perspective right now on the dining scene that's quite different.
That's Honeysuckle Provisions.
Honeysuckle Provisions.
That's one to keep your eye on for
from,
sure.
From, say, for example, Her Place Supper Club, which is Amanda Shulman's original one. And, she was a real trendsetter in getting that going.
I love it. By the way, Patricia emails, I live in Northeast Philadelphia, and we like to go to that Thai restaurant. Food is authentic.
Okay. That's a recommendation
for Patricia. Got to ask you, you went from the Bells to now just best list. What does it take to get on your list? Like, what are all the things that you consider when you're deciding who gets to be on these lists?
Yeah, well, you know, it's a, first of all, Philadelphia is a huge city. I'm glad you had a reader from Northeast Philly, because I love eating in Northeast Philadelphia. I think it's underexposed.
Did you have like a series on Northeast Philly?
I did a few years ago. Yeah. It was one of my favorite things I ever did. I ate, I don't know, like 50 different restaurants in Northeast Philadelphia. It's basically like our Queens in a way. It's like this.
It's like the United Nations.
Absolutely. Yeah. It's where a lot of, you know, immigrant families end up settling, and you see a lot of these communities. And actually, one of my best of lists last year included a Georgian restaurant up there called Gamarjoba. You know, there's a lot of the post-Soviet Union immigration ended up in Northeast Philly, and it's so fun to explore and learn and experience all these things. So my method is to get out there and eat everywhere. And I cover, you know, from expensive places down to street food restaurants, food trucks. I write about everything, because there's good food everywhere you look, and there's great hospitality in all kinds of forms. So Philadelphia has that, you know, and so I get out and about. You know, I follow what's new. My colleague Michael Klein is absolutely, you know, covers everything that opens, and I follow his column religiously. He just put out a column of 30 new restaurants to pay attention to this spring. That was after,
that's a lot of eating.
But that was after the column of 75 new restaurants that came out in January.
That's crazy.
So your mind can really get dizzy just trying to keep track of what's new. I try to get a great diversity of flow from week to week, different styles, different neighborhoods, different price points. I do like restaurants. So the days are over when I write about every restaurant that opens in Philadelphia. Maybe 25 years ago,
you could do that.
You could kind of do that. And that the pace has picked up to the point where it's really about where the restaurant, you know, the quality has to be there. I have to be interested in the food, but I also want to tell some sort of a story, or has some sort of meaning, a sort of impact that helps kind of make it a more important story for readers in our full coverage would want to know about this restaurant.
It's interesting.
By the way, Patricia, the restaurant is White Elephant.
It's called White Elephant on Huntington Pike.
I'm going to have to check out White Elephant.
So before we get you out of here, I just wanted to ask you, we only have about 90 seconds. What's it been like watching the whole cottage industry of Instagram and TikTok food reviewers explode? Some of these people are sort of more coming from the promotional side. Some of them are doing more sort of legit reviews, and some of them have humongous followings. What's it been like from your perspective watching sort of the social media food review sensation take off?
Well, it's been interesting. Yeah. I mean, you know, it's definitely a different perspective from the way I approach it. You know, my approach has been to tell stories about the restaurants. And so often I find a lot of the social media food commentators are, look at me going to a restaurant and you can watch me eating at
this
restaurant.
It's their personality where you're anonymous.
It's more of a branding exercise. That said, social media has been a great equalizer for a lot of small businesses.
Totally.
And it has sort of certainly dramatically changed the dining scene and the access to being able to. I found out about oxtail cheesesteaks because of a really great local influencer named JL Jupiter.
Yeah.
He does a great.
And now you have a.
He does a great job.
And now
you have a story today about oxtail cheesesteaks, right?
That's right.
Yeah, and made me hungry reading it this morning. By the way, thank you very much.
$30 cheesesteak, but you say it's worth it.
It is worth it if you like oxtails, first of all, which are wonderful, but they're very expensive. It's 60% bone, so there's a lot of low yield on the meat, but they're wonderful. They take hours to cook, and it's another thing, another wonder to explore in Philadelphia's dining scene.
Another delicious wonder
of the Philly dining scene. Well, that's Craig LeBand, knows it better than anyone else. Philadelphia Inquirer restaurant critic and drink columnist. Craig, it's an honor to talk with you on the show.
I'm so glad to be here.
Yeah.
Yay. And coming up next on Studio 2, feeling a little tense or anxious? How about a sound bath? We'll talk about that with Mike and Scott after this. Welcome back to Studio 2. I'm Cherry Gregg.
And I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt. Listen to that sound. Relax. Breathe. Let it wash over you. That is the soundtrack for a sound bath, which is an approach to meditation and healing.
And these days, who couldn't use some tips for relaxation. Mike and Scott, who you know as the host of the WHYY Science and Health Show, The Pulse, recently indulged in a sound bath, and she's here to tell us all about her experience. Mike, and welcome back to Studio 2. We're speaking like this because...
We have to break out of this at some point.
I know. This, the music feel very peaceful.
You guys are freaking me out. All right, let's bring some stress back into this equation here. So I went to a sound bath at the Away Spa at W Philadelphia, which is a hotel. And my friend there, who I met on that day, Luna May, she is the resident sound therapy practitioner. She was my guide. So you come in. It's a very pretty room. It has a bed that looks a little bit like, you know, a massage bench, but also more like a bed. Yeah. You lie down. She puts a mask on your face so you can't see anything. The room is really pretty. And I just felt very calm just going into the room. I have to say, when I got there, it was one of those days when I just had so many things to do. And I'm like, how am I going to make it all happen? When I was there, I'm like, ooh. And then she starts playing all this music. So you're completely in the dark. The music starts playing. Let's hear a little bit more of what it sounds like. So pretty, right?
That's pretty different from the first one, actually.
Yes. Yeah. So it really varies. It really varies. And you can't quite tell where the music is coming from, right? Sometimes it feels like she's right behind you. Sometimes it feels like she's on the left, on the right. But it just was this amazing experience. And she was playing the music live while I was there. And then afterwards, she explained a bit more about the process.
So what was on the sonic menu for today was Crystal Alchemy Singing Bowls, which for me have a really soft, grounding sonic texture to them. And the harmonics that you were hearing and the overtones are what make these sound healing instruments so exquisite. So even though I'm actually moving about the room, the natural way these instruments express themselves kind of paint the walls, so you never really know where it's coming from. And they never sound the same. Like, no two sound bath treatments sound the same.
Wow. I love to meditate. And it seems like the sound bath makes you be present.
Yes. So I have to admit that meditation is very hard for me because when I'm doing a more traditional meditation, maybe guided, maybe breathing, I'm constantly like feeling edgy. I'm like, I should be doing laundry. I should be making dinner. I should be checking the script. But when I was there, it felt like I had a job. You know, I had a job because I had to listen to the music, and that made me like calm enough to just like chill out, if that makes any sense.
Wow. So you and so what did it do with your mind? Like, how did you feel? How did it de-stress you?
Yeah, I think something that happens, and I was wondering if we could listen to one more clip from from Luna here, because she kind of explained something that happened throughout the process.
I use acrylic mallets wrapped in a rubber casing, and I'm holding one of the bowls with like a crystal wand on it. They're made of pure quartz and they're infused with different minerals from around the world that give it their unique sound and texture. And then for this one, I can actually wave it around you, creating that spatial audio binaural sensation to allow your body to really drop down into theta state a little bit more efficiently in a shorter amount of time.
Theta state.
Yes.
Okay, so what's she talking about?
Yes, so she's talking about theta brainwaves, which is one of the five electrical pulses your brain produces. They tend to happen when you're very relaxed, when you're about to go to sleep. And you probably know when you sometimes you go into a little bit of a dream, you're kind of like you're falling asleep and all of a sudden you're like, no, that didn't happen. You know, something you just realize like, oh, I was dreaming. And that happened to me three or four times in the short amount of period during that sound bath where I was like listening, I was drifting off, then I was coming back. So it really allowed me to relax much more quickly than I personally can if I try to meditate.
Theta state, that's a real scientific classification. And you felt yourself going into that theta state. And is there evidence that these sound baths do get you into the theta state?
Yeah. So You know, sound bathing is still relatively new, but there is some research and it has shown in smaller studies to lead to relaxation. Mm. They have tried it with patients who are about to have a procedure to see how agitated or relaxed they are going into a surgical procedure. They have tried it for pain reduction and, again, stress reduction. And in all those cases, it has shown a benefit. So I would say, you know, it's still new, but it definitely seems to be one tool out there in our universe of stress reduction.
Hmm. And stress reduction is a big business.
Oh, yes.
And so are there any other tools? Because you seem to really like the sound baths. So are there any other tools that you gravitate toward?
I think, you know, stress reduction has become a billion-dollar industry, right? And we hear all the time about stress, why it's so bad for us. It is not always bad for us. You know, some stress is part of life. Mm-hmm. You know, sometimes I think we get this sense like we should just be lulling about on the couch and feel at peace. It's not going to happen, right? We're going to feel stressed a bunch of times each day. It's more when it gets into like every part of our day and we find ourselves at a 9 with our head about to pop. That's not good, right? So stress reduction, I think, doesn't have to cost money, and each person can find their own tools. And something that I have found works really well for me is what I call micro moments of joy. But I will not charge for that. No, but just like these short moments, a short moment, take a breath, feel your breath, feel your feet on the ground, let your shoulders drop. Do you ever like during the day? Yeah, thank you, Avi. Like during the day, I'm like, my shoulders are glued to my ears. I'm like, what am I doing?
That's a stress position.
Yes. Yeah. So just letting the shoulders drop. Take that deep breath. Take 3 deep breaths. You know, put your phone away. Those kinds of things I think are free. They don't have to cost anything. And sure, you can take a meditation class or you can go to a beautiful sound bath. Amazing. But when you don't want to spend money, you can also do those
sound things. Sound baths pretty expensive.
You know what? They really range. I find that they can be very reasonable. You can also do them in a group setting. I've done a sound bath in combination with an ice bath.
Oh my goodness.
Here I am in the bubble bath like an idiot.
No, you got to try the ice bath. You got to try the ice bath. That's a whole other story. We can do that next time.
That's very hot right now, I've heard. No pun intended.
Ice baths are hot.
Could you come back on the show and do an ice bath explainer for us?
Yes, okay. I will absolutely do that. I loved the ice bath. But again, you know, a sound bath is a wonderful thing. It's becoming more popular. You can find them in all kinds of settings and places. And I would say give it a shot.
That sound means the show is over for us. But Mike and Scott, host of the WHYY's The Pulse, thank you so much for putting us at ease and sharing that experience with us. Very cool.
Take a deep breath.
I love it.
Did you see this email here?
Yes.
Jim says, we need to have a great show today because we entertain him on 22-mile hikes. I hope we did the job today, Jim.
And I hope we made those miles fly by. That's it for our show. Our producers are Debbie Builder and Andreas Copes, Diana Martinez. No.
Al Banks
engineered today's show from Studio 2 at WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Cherry Gray.
And I'm Abby Wolfman.